What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, friends. What's up? Another New Evangelicals podcast is here. I have a very special guest on this one. I had the chance to interview Paula Stone Williams, who just wrote a book, As a Woman, What I Learned About Power, Sex, and Patriarchy After I Transitioned. Paula Stone Williams is an internationally known speaker on issues of gender equity, LGBTQ advocacy, and religious tolerance. It's been a long day, friends. She has been featured in TED Women, TED Summit, The New York Times, Red Table Talk, TEDx Mile High, The Washington Post, NPR, Good Morning America, CNN, ABC News, and scores of other media outlets. Okay, finished. So I brought her on so we could talk about her journey, about her being a pastor, about her fight for women's rights, about her time as a CEO in a very large church planting network and all other kinds of things. So I hope you enjoy this episode. It is certainly one that makes you sit and have to think a lot, especially after the interview was done. So thank you, Paula, for coming on. I really appreciate it. That being said, friends, I just want to say thank you. As I do, I know it's the same kind of flow. Okay. Every single intro, I get that, but I honestly mean it every single time. I am so grateful for everyone who is sharing and listening to this podcast. We continue to grow, which means a lot because one of our goals at New Evangelicals is to be a safe place where people can come and realize that they're not alone in their faith walk, right? I think a lot of people feel that maybe they're isolated or that no one else thinks this way about their Christian faith or about Jesus. And these kinds of podcasts, and I'm just one of many, hopefully become safe havens for people to realize that, hey, I'm actually not alone. So thank you to everyone who is doing that work. It is super important. Also want to say thank you to all of our supporters out there. We are currently in the middle of a big fundraising project called Finding Our Voices. We are trying to raise monthly funding that will allow us to produce a docuseries where we actually film on location and elevate the stories of those in our community that have been hurt by church, that have experienced abuse. And our goal is to tell those stories so people hear them and that the church hopefully starts to listen, that the institutions that we are a part of are actually hurting people. So if you can go to the link that's in our show notes or in the comments section on YouTube and check it out, that'd be so great. We are getting there, my friends. We are about 35% funded out of our base goal. And our next step is to raise enough money so I can start doing this on a full-time basis. Right now, full transparency, okay? Full transparency. I juggle a lot of things, okay? I have a full-time job. I do this about 30 plus hours a week, plus our family, and my wife is pregnant. So I believe in this, and this is our goal. So anything that you're able to give monthly sincerely goes right to helping us do this better and better each time. And also, we are in the process of forming the New Evangelicals as a nonprofit, which is so exciting. That means that all of your donations will become tax deductible. So our application is in process. We're getting ready to submitted hopefully this week. And so that is on the way. And that's all because of the work and of the finances you guys have given. So a sincere thank you to all of our donors. Honestly, it truly helps directly. There's a direct causation of your giving. So if you're able to give, that'd be great. But if not, it's okay. I get it. I know these are tight times for a lot of us. I totally understand that. And no matter what, it is our goal to always be a paywall-free community, meaning we don't hide anything behind a paywall. Everything we do is free. Our Zoom groups are free. Our sessions are free. Everything we do, no cost. And that is always our goal. So, all right, friends, enough of me rambling. That was a long ramble. Sorry, not sorry, right? Here is my interview with Paula Stone Williams. I hope you enjoy it. Well, Paula, I am, like I said before we started recording, I am honored to have you on the New Evangelicals podcast. I think my audience has a lot to learn from you as well as I do. So thanks for making the time late on the East Coast for me and for coming on. I appreciate it.
Well, it's happy to be with you.
Well, I got to be honest. My admin is the one who recommended me to you. She said, you know, you should check out Paula Williams. I think she has a great story. I think your audience would love her. And I said, let me check her out. And I did some searching. I'm like, oh, yeah. I got to see if Paula will be willing to hop on. So, you know, I don't know if my audience is super familiar with you right now. I know that you have a book that just came out. And I'm not going to ask you to read the whole book to us. But why don't you kind of give us just some of your background, where you've been and where you are now. We can hop into all the good stuff.
Yeah, a little bit of what's going on recently is I did a TED Talk in 2017, the fall of 2017, that's had over 4.25 million views on YouTube, which then caused me to be asked to speak for TED itself with my son in 2018. And then I spoke again for another TEDx event in 2019. And then I was approached by Simon & Schuster about doing a memoir. And so I've had a ton of media coverage over the last 4 years, really all out of that very first TED Talk. And that first TED Talk, I think its title is I've Lived as a Man, I've Lived as a Woman, and Here's What I've Learned.
Yes.
So most of what I speak on is actually not about being transgender. Most of what I speak on is gender equity. Basically, I'm saying there's no way a well-educated white American male can understand how much the culture is tilted in his favor because it's all he's ever known and all he ever will know. And I actually speak, actually all over the world on that subject, corporations, universities, conferences. So I don't actually speak all that often on being transgender.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that because I did watch the TED Talk again earlier today. I said, this was not what I expected. You know, I think I just kind of assumed, right, which obviously kind of bit me in the butt. But I was like, oh, this is more about like economic justice and, you know, gender equity. And I honestly am very interested in all those topics as well, because as I've been kind of thinking more and more, and I grew up in a very conservative, you know, Rush Limbaugh type home, undoing some of that and realizing like actually our society is not very just when it comes to our work and how we you know distribute finances and stuff. So I think that we could definitely hit some of that if you're cool with it during this time, because I'm very curious to hear your thoughts. Like you said, living as both at one point a man and now a woman, I think that is a very unique perspective. Why don't you kind of give my audience, you know, those listening, just some of the background of kind of how you got from point A to point B?
Sure. I knew from the time I was 3 or 4 years of age, I was transgender. And in my naivete, and I think my white male privilege, I thought I got to choose. I somehow had fashioned this notion that I got to choose my gender and that sometime before kindergarten, a gender fairy would arrive and say, okay, the time's come. And that never happened. So I started school, and a lot of trans women will tell you, and that's what I am, a trans woman, a person who's gone from male to female is a trans woman, female to male is a trans man. But a lot of trans women had an experience where they say they felt like a girl in a boy's body, and they always hated being a boy. No, that's not me. I never felt like a girl in a boy's body. I always felt like I was supposed to have been born a girl. And I didn't hate being a boy. I just knew I wasn't one. So once I realized that, you know, I had no real choice, my father was a fundamentalist pastor, my mother was even more conservative, it wasn't terrible. It was a fine childhood. But then I got to puberty, and all of my friends who were girls had bodies changing in the ways I wanted mine to, and my body was changing in ways I absolutely hated. And I was attracted to girls and still am. Your gender identity is not your sexual identity. Your sexual identity is who you want to go to bed with. Your gender identity is who you want to go to bed as. And so I was attracted to girls, but I would also find it difficult because I wanted to be the girl to whom I was attracted. So I got a primo job as a disc jockey at a large radio station in Kentucky as a 16-year-old, because doesn't everybody get that kind of a job?
Of course.
And I got a scholarship offer to the University of Kentucky, and I actually did not take it. I instead took a scholarship to a Christian university because I was terrified, because I knew I was transgender, and there wasn't even a name for it at that point. I rushed home from high school in my senior year to see Merv Griffin interview Christine Jorgensen, the first well-known trans person from the 1950s. Nobody knew anything. There were no books in the library, nothing. And so I was terrified of being that way. And I thought, well, if I go to a Christian college, you know, somehow that'll fix it. And, you know, just in case anybody out there is thinking it might, it doesn't, doesn't fix it. So at college, I began dating a girl who I wanted to date and did not want to be. And it's like, ooh, this is much nicer. And I ended up marrying her. And because of being a child, growing up in that pure movement. And Linda K. Klein is a good friend of mine. Her book has been amazing. But I thought that sex would cure me. I thought that having intercourse with my partner on our wedding night would cure me, and it did not. And so I woke up the next morning, literally saying, oh, I'm in trouble because I thought this would be okay now. And so I had not told her before we married. I told her not long after that. And I told her what I understood at the time, which was not much. And so we thought, well, we can work through this together.
Yeah.
And then when we had kids, I really loved being a dad. I still do. And so it went on a back burner, but then the kids left home. And with gender dysphoria, which is what it's called in the DSM-5.
Yeah.
Which is a consistent, persistent sense that you are not inhabiting a body that is consistent with the gender you see yourself as. When the kids left home, it started getting worse and worse and worse, and finally got to the point that it was a huge problem in my life. And then I was called to transition, which is an interesting thing for an evangelical. I mean, I've always been evangelical. I led one of the largest church planting organizations in the nation. At some point or another, I've preached in, I think, 3 of the 10 largest churches in the U.S., or at least the 10 largest 5 or 6 years ago. I don't know about now.
Sure.
But I never really had felt a strong sense of call. And I was watching my favorite television show of all time, Lost.
Oh, great show.
And, and in the final year.
I was,
Were you a Lost fan?
I was a huge Lost fan until the final season. Then they lost me.
I think the final season was brilliant. I think Carlton Cuse, you know, Cuse is a good Catholic. And so it took me a while after seeing the final show to realize everything taking place in LA was purgatory.
Yeah.
Everything taking place on the island was real. And they just had to work through a bunch of stuff before they could go to heaven together. Once I realized that, I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
But there's a point in the final season, as a Lost fan.
Sure.
It's the first time Jack goes to the lighthouse, sees in the broken mirror his home. And he realizes he's been called by Jacob, the God figure, to die.
Yeah.
And of course, he's the Christ figure. And I started sobbing, and I sobbed until 2 in the morning, fell asleep on the couch, woke up at about 5 and just sobbed till maybe noon because I knew I had been called. And I was like, God, who the blank do you think you are to call me to this? I'm going to lose everything.
Yeah.
And I was called, and I ignored that call for 2 years because that's what you do when you're called under the hero's journey, because the hero's journey is always under the road of trials, and no one willingly goes onto the road of trials. So you reject the call of God, and then finally you're miserable because you know you've been called, and then a spiritual guide, a Yoda, comes into your life, and you accept the call under the road of trials. I mean, this is the hero's journey in every culture, every age, every language, every ethnicity, every people group.
Right.
And you get into the road of trials, and sure enough, it's a road of trials. And then it gets worse. You get lost in this deep, dark cave. And that's where you find out that it's all right because lost is a place too. And that for me was rejecting the call was that 2 years. And then I transitioned and lost all my jobs within 7 days.
Yeah.
You cannot be fired for being transgender in all 50 states of the U.S. unless you work for a religious corporation.
Yes. Yeah.
So I lost all my jobs within 7 days. I'd never had a bad review. Only had success in my life. And that was that deep, dark cave where you know, Dante's language at the beginning of the Divine Comedy, in the middle of the road of my life, I awoke in a dark wood where the true way was wholly lost. Yeah, that was that. And I still have not transitioned. I only came out as trans. And about 6 months later, I finally transitioned. And of course, the evangelical world instantly got rid of me. I lost my pension, which was conservatively worth $750,000. I had to actually threaten a lawsuit to get money of mine back that the organization was holding. It was a really horrible, horrible experience. And I made less money in the next 4 years as Paula than I made in the last 2 months as Paul. Wow. So it was a pretty horrible time. And then I ran across a post-evangelical church in Denver, Denver Community Church. At the time, it was about 8 years old, running about 800. And within a couple of months, I was on their preaching team. And then I started working with Denver Community Church, which is a church of a couple thousand that became fully open and affirming a couple of years ago. More than that now, about 4 years ago. And I began working a lot with them. And that's what took me then on the TED route. Someone heard an interview we had done with Colorado Public Radio and invited me to speak for TEDx Mile High in Denver, which is one of the largest TEDx's in the world. And the rest, as they say, is history. So those two churches, plus my son's church in Brooklyn, combined to plant the church I pastor now, Left Hand Church. Yeah. And it's kind of funny because we used to start churches back in the day at the Orchard Group with $800,000 to $1.2 million.
Yeah.
And, you know, a huge staff. And we started this church with $80,000. And we have four part-time co-pastors. And it's been a wonderful experience. Well, that catches you up.
I honestly, you know your story. You could say,
I can tell stories fast. I preached a sermon on the entire history of religion in 23 minutes, just 3 weeks ago.
My goodness. I should give you a round of applause. It's impressive. Okay. Wow. First off, thank you for sharing. Really powerful. So I was taking down notes on my screen over here as you were talking. You know, one of my questions I was wondering as you were realizing this part about yourself, right? Did your faith and like who you were ever feel at odds with each other? Because I have people in my community who would tell me like, I feel like I'm fighting this. I don't know what to do about this. Did you ever feel like, oh, my faith can't be reconciled? Because I get that a lot on my end.
I never did.
For you. Okay.
No, even as an evangelical.
Yeah.
I was, I never ever thought of being transgender as being any kind of sin, because it's not. I mean, it's not mentioned in the Bible. And so even with an evangelical theology, I had no difficulty with it. I just once I knew what it was, didn't want to destroy my family, my wife and my children.
Right.
But no, I never had any difficulty with it. And probably personally, I had moved on the issues of the LGB issue. I'd moved on probably by the early 80s on that issue. I was just in a denomination where I couldn't be public about it. So I think I wrongly now, but I remember hiring a guy who's still a friend in, I think it was the late 80s. And he said, you know, I'm gay. And I said, yep. And as long as you're not in a relationship with somebody, we'll never have a problem with that. And he came to me at one point and said, I think I want to be in a relationship. And I said, well, you know, okay, now you probably need to resign. And I deeply regret that, because I think in not taking a stand, people were dying. There's no more at-risk group of people on earth for suicide than LGBTQ children of evangelical parents who are not supportive of them. They have a suicide rate 13 times higher than their peers. So I think I did a very grave disjustice or injustice to all of those people by not earlier stating my position on those issues.
I've, You know, I work a lot in the deconstruction field. I'm sure you've heard of that term before, you know, that people who are, you know, rethinking their faith and just kind of, I call it a crisis of theology is what it is for most people that I encounter. And one of the reasons that people get so scared about that is because they're in these evangelical spaces, they're fully plugged in, and they just don't want to lose the friends that they made. And they know that once they, in their own way, come out theologically with certain issues, right? That's all on the line. Was that hard for you to know that you were really risking perhaps very close relationships with people that you no longer have?
I think as a powerful white male, I had no idea the price I would pay. I thought all of my friends, and in our denomination, which had about 7,000 churches, I was clearly a national leader. And I thought, well, all these people have, there are two options. You can either think to yourself, oh my goodness, Paul is transgender. I must not understand what it means to be transgender. I need to go back and study that because I certainly know Paul's character. That was option A.
Right.
Option B was, oh my goodness, Paul wasn't who I thought he was. He didn't have the character I thought he had. He's transgender and he's going to hell. And I had no idea how many people would, thousands, almost all, would choose that option. And I knew thousands and thousands of people by name in that world. And I've kept in contact, continual contact with, continuing contact all the way through with four.
Wow. That had to take a toll. I mean, I say that only because I've recently been asked to step down from my volunteer drumming position, you know, as a white straight male, because I believe, you know, for LGBTQ inclusion, and I've lost like 10 friends, and that's been very painful for me, right? People that I thought I'd be friends with all the way, we would do great things together, are just no longer in my life. So I can only imagine, if we compounded that, how that must have felt for you.
Well, yeah, and I lost no non-evangelical friends, not one. I was a pastoral counselor at the time, in addition to the other work I was doing. And I had a number of evangelical clients. I lost none of them.
Wow.
I was prepared to give all of them a referral to someone else. And, you know, they all knew me deeply enough as their therapist that they were all okay.
Wow. It seems like you wear a lot of hats. So you're a therapist, you're a pastor. You were?
My doctorate's in pastoral counseling.
Wow.
I did adoption casework for like 25 years. I was in television for 18 years. I was in radio for seven. I'm a Renaissance person. adjunct professor at universities in the U.S. and Europe. I was wonderful. My first seminary experience, my last year of that master's program, I had a professor who took me aside, an adjunct professor who took me inside. You're a Renaissance person. Everybody's going to tell you you can only do one thing. And you're not ever going to be that person who can just do one thing. You need to give yourself permission to do that. He at the time was a mega church lead pastor and a Christian university president. And he actually is one of the four people still in touch with me.
Wow. So, you know,
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Curious to kind of get your temperature check here on why do you think the evangelical movement in general is really so, I'm not sure what the right language is, but just so, vehemently opposed to the transgender community, you know, in their spaces, to the queer community in their spaces. Right. I mean, it seems like for me, it's way beyond just theology. There's something deeper going on, but I would like to get maybe your thoughts on that.
I actually won't really discuss the theology of it because it's not about theology. And I frankly don't have time for that. My time's in demand and I'm going to have productive conversations and those aren't.
Right.
I can have them, but I'm not interested in having them. I'm a fan of the work of Edward O. Wilson, E.O. Wilson, a sociobiologist at Harvard and MIT, who's won a couple of Pulitzer Prizes. One was in identifying that the key social unit for the human species is not the family, which was quite a surprise at the time. It's in fact the tribe. In fact, this is actually good news for religion because all the modern atheists will tell you that religion is terrible, awful, horrible. But the truth is we never really took off as a species. As long as we were focused on blood kin, we took off as a species when we became a tribal species. And what is it that brought us together as a tribal species? It was not the need for safety. It was man's search for meaning. That's why Viktor Frankl's book still sells in the top 10.
Yep.
All the time. Book. You know, think Stonehenge, think of burial mounds of indigenous Americans. You know, it was trying to fashion meaning out of this consciousness we have that includes death. And so religion actually caused us to propel much more quickly forward. That's when civilizations began to develop. That's when language developed. So religion was the reason, or the search for meaning was actually the reason we became a tribal species. And there are only 9 tribal species. All of them, Wilson calls eusocial species, E-U, S-O-C-I-A-L. And he, so his first Pulitzer Prize was in identifying that humans were were primarily a tribal species. And his second was in identifying these 9 new social species. Yeah. And all 9 have what he would call a tribal gene. Like every other species, they have a selfish gene, but they also have a tribal gene. They are willing to, when an enemy comes into the camp, join together, sacrifice themselves, defeat the enemy. Some of them die, but life goes on. But he says, unfortunately, as we have evolved as a species, 8 of the 9 species have evolved exactly as you would expect. That has continued. The species have strengthened. He said, unfortunately, the 9th eusocial species has evolved to believe an enemy is necessary for the tribe to survive. And where no enemy exists, we create one. He said, if we don't get a hold of that, we lose the species and quite possibly the planet. And the best short explanation of that, if you just look up E.O. Wilson on Fresh Air, his interview with Terry Gross on that it's only an hour long and it's marvelous and is a much better presentation of what I just said. But that is the issue. That we create enemies that don't exist.
Yeah.
The place that creates enemies that don't exist and always has is the desert expression or the fundamentalist expression of the desert religions. So all three desert religions, all three Abrahamic religions began as religions of scarcity. Mm. There aren't enough resources to go around, so I've got to take care of me and mine. And in their non-fundamentalist forms, all three, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, have evolved to be very generous religions. Yeah. Unfortunately, in their fundamentalist expressions, they continue to be religions of scarcity.
Yeah,
there are not enough resources to go around. So if my tribe's going to survive, then we must defeat the enemies. And if there are no obvious enemies, then we'll create enemies that don't exist. Mm. So that is, in fact, what's happened. I have another opinion that probably a lot of your viewers and listeners won't necessarily like. And that is that the patriarchal church, the male-led church, has been almost purely patriarchal. And so if you are a man and you run your religious world and you want to choose a social issue to become concerned about, you might subconsciously choose a social issue that personally costs you nothing. So I find it just worth considering that in the evangelical and fundamentalist Christian world, and it crosses over into Roman Catholicism and crosses over into Islam, that the two issues they've chosen are woman's choice and LGBTQ issues. Well, none of these leaders are women, and 3% or so are LGBTQ. So if you take those up as social positions, that's not going to cost you anything, as it would cost you if you took up socioeconomic injustice or, systemic racism. Well, now that's going to cost me something.
Right.
So I think that is, in fact, what's going on. I say that in my book. My book is As a Woman, What I Learned About Power, Sex, and Patriarchy After I Transitioned. It's published by Simon & Schuster, so you can find it anywhere. But there are 15 chapters on my journey, and then there are 2 chapters on gender inequity, and then there are 2 chapters on my religion in America behaves in the way in which it does, and then a chapter on sex as a man and sex as a woman, and then an ending chapter. But I say all that in those 2 chapters if anybody wants to take a look at it. Again, yeah, well, As a Woman.
Yeah. I'll definitely put it in the show notes. And like I said, it's on my list to pick up. I have one more book ahead of yours, and it's on my list. I'm looking forward to it. I want to comment on what you said, because I think it's really well stated and it's very accurate, because I have, you know, been thinking a lot lately of like, yeah, why aren't we talking about like the problem of capitalism creating like mass poverty, like all over the place? I mean, in America, you know, like, let alone across the world, and how it's destroying the planet, how it's destroying women and other people who are not pretty much white males. And I like you, I grew up steeped in evangelical culture, homeschooled, the whole nine, you know, never heard a sermon in my 32 years of life on this planet from a pulpit of a pastor talking about how we have to think about the wage gap, you know, how like what Amazon's doing is ruining the middle class. But I've heard a lot of sermons about how they're coming for your kids, you know, the gay agenda is here, or, you know, Black Lives Matter is Marxist. And I just keep thinking like, wow, this just, it doesn't make any sense. It can't be. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, like you said, it can't be a theological conversation we're having. That, and I admire you for not going there, because you're right. It's really a fool's errand, right? You'll get stuck in the weeds there forever, arguing over nonsensical things, because it's not about that. Like you said, there's something deeper driving this. I'm reminded of, I just watched Pray Away today on Netflix, the documentary about, you know, the Exodus International movement, and they bring up the great point that the anti-gay movement was planned with politics intentionally to keep a certain group of power over other people. So I think your point is just right on the money. You're spot on.
Yep. Yeah, I'm pretty convinced it's accurate. And so, you know, I just take a look at the at where we're headed, you know, what the trends are. 83% of Jewish population is supportive of marriage equality. 71% of Catholics, not the Catholic leadership in the U.S., the Catholic leadership in the U.S. is a problem. 63% of mainline Protestants are supportive of marriage equality, 37% of evangelicals, but 51% of millennial evangelicals. It's just a matter of time. And what happened is with marriage equality, the evangelical world realized they'd lost on that one. Mm-hmm. And evangelicals, if nothing, they're not stupid. Right. They also know that they eventually have got to move on this issue because the culture has moved on. Yeah. And to continue to hold this position means they'll lose the next generation. And as one large, respected megachurch pastor told me just a couple of years ago, you know where I am on this, but my money isn't. Yeah. They're going to move on this issue. So, well, what else can maintain my control? Oh, well, how about if we move on to the gender dysphoria issue? Let's just move on to the transgender people. Yes. And then attempt to create a scriptural rationale for that is just pitifully inadequate. It's like, I mean, really, a Bible college freshman could argue down that argument.
Right.
So it's pitiful. But, you know, and of course, the terrible part about that is they're now enacting laws. And everybody says, well, it's the conservative Republicans enacting these laws. And there are over 300 of them pending right now, and over a dozen that have been signed into law. They are all targeting the civil rights of transgender children. And you say, who's driving these laws? And everybody says, well, it's conservative Republicans. It's actually not. Hmm. A study was done, and it's a Pew Research study. I believe it's Pew. It's one of the really big ones. I'm not absolutely positive of that, but easy to find. They studied those who voted for Donald Trump in the 10 swing states in the last election.
Yeah.
And then asked them a number of additional questions. And one of them was, should transgender people have the same civil rights as anyone else? 61% said yes. Then who's driving these laws through Republican legislatures?
Right.
Oh, well, 84% of evangelicals believe gender is immutably determined at birth. And 61% of those people think that our nation is already giving too many civil rights to transgender people. And yet only 25% of them know someone who is out as a transgender person.
Mm-hmm.
So it's evangelicals driving these laws.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, they're killing children.
I'm just sitting with what you just said.
Yeah.
Let that soak in for a minute.
Yeah. I wish it wasn't true. It's
horrible.
But it is. Yeah.
So, okay, I'm in evangelical spaces still, technically. Like, you know, I count as the new evangelicals, right? We're trying to push the church forward. That's like my big thing, full transparency. You know, what do I do? Like, help me out here, you know? Like, how do I use my platform and how do we use this community to start, like, saving the lives of transgender children, right? Because I want to be part of that help. So what do you think?
You know, I haven't looked at any stuff related to this in the last maybe year. And I just happened to run across some stuff today on mimetic theory with René Girard, who was a philosopher anthropologist. And he says, you know, when what happened in the development of our species is when people gained power, they didn't want to give up that power.
Right.
So they had to figure out how to maintain that power. And so they would create enemies within the camp. And they would say, oh, well, it's time for a change in regimes. Oh, well, no, we can't do that because there are enemies in the camp and I'm the only one who can identify them. And so all of that to say, the point that the article was making is we'll do almost anything to hang on to our power. And frankly, it's not going to happen until people like me do what I was not willing to do. And, you know, we would have lost probably 80% of our financial support if I had brought our organization out probably when I was fully ready to, maybe 1989 or 90. Well, we should have done that. We would have been fine. It would have been a different organization. We would have figured out how to plant churches on a shoestring instead, but we would have been fine. But I liked my power and my comfort. You know, my third TED Talk is about men willingly giving up power.
Yeah.
My first TED Talks had 4.25 million views. The third hasn't quite hit 500,000 yet because men really don't like watching it. Because I say that really the only way to get gender equity is for you to actually step down and give your position to a woman. You know, 5.8% of Fortune 500 CEOs are women, 6.6% of Silicon Valley CEOs are women,
right.
3% of venture capital goes to female-founded firms. Women earn 81 cents or 89 cents on the dollar, or 81 cents on the dollar for men earn. Black women, 64 cents on the dollar, Native American women, 59 cents on the dollar, Hispanic American women, 54 cents on the dollar. We're not ever going to get there until guys are willing to say, I will take less to pay you more. And I think there are plenty of young Gen X, millennial, certainly Gen Z, evangelical leaders who know the truth. They just really don't want to pay the price you just paid in having to go off of a board because of the position you've taken publicly. Mm-hmm. By the way, churches that become completely open and affirming, they lose, best as we can tell, about 20% of their people and 20% of their income. It takes about a year to get the 20% of people back, but it takes about three to get the 20% of income back.
Let's switch gears to what seems to be like really your passion, you know, which is the socioeconomic conversation. I really would like to go there if you have a few minutes.
Sure.
You know, What for you was like the big shift in going from like, I'm sure you seem like you're very intelligent. You're obviously well-read. I'm sure you've known these stats for a long time. What was the moment where things switched for you where you said, okay, I have to be like an advocate and an activist in this realm now when it comes to, you know, socioeconomic issues?
It's the first day that I ever flew as a woman. I've flown over 2.5 million miles with American Airlines. I've been at their top level for decades. And I got on the plane and there was stuff in my seat and I picked it up and put my stuff down. And a guy said, that's my stuff. And I said, okay, but it's in my seat. And he said, lady, that is my seat. And I said, actually, it's not. It's my seat, 1D. And yes, I always get the free upgrades.
Of course.
I said, but you know, I'll be glad to hold your stuff till you find your seat. And he said, lady, I don't know what I need to tell you. That is my seat. And I said, yeah, actually, it's not. You know, at which point the guy behind me said, lady, would you take your effing argument elsewhere so I can get in the plane? And I was stunned. And so finally, the flight attendant took our boarding passes. And, you know, it was aggravating to me because I can tell you what would have happened when I was a guy. When I was a guy, I would have said that. And immediately the guy would have looked at his boarding pass because he would have assumed I knew what I was talking about. He would have seen he was in the wrong seat and he would have said, oh, I'm sorry, but no, I have to get the flight attendant to do it. And she tells him that and he no apology, no nothing. And then, you know, mister, would you take your effing argument elsewhere? Is next to me in the other seat.
Right.
And I was just stunned. And seriously. So my friend, Karen, who works for American, came on the plane, gave the paperwork to the captain, waved goodbye. I get to Charlotte. She called me and she said, what happened? And I told her and she said, oh, Paula, welcome to the world of women. So it was my personal experience that taught me this. And then as I began to study it, I began to truly deeply study it and realized how deep the inequity is. I mean, we're 100 years away from pay equity, let alone anything else. Really? You know, like, I mean, 47% of first and second year law associates are women, only 15% make partner. Mothers with children at home are 44% less likely to be hired for a job, even though they are better multitaskers, take fewer unnecessary risks, and are incredibly capable in making the right kinds of decisions to grow the company. I mean, the statistics go on and on and on.
Wow. What are your thoughts on like the corporate model as a whole in America? Like I've been thinking about my thoughts lately have been, okay, like life is more than just, you know, working hard for someone else, especially a corporation, as they really suck up labor and pay you, especially now the wages are just so stagnant. We all know that. We know that companies like Amazon and, you know, Walmart, Apple, who I've worked for before, have just, you know, exploded in profit during COVID. You know, Jeff Bezos is flying to space. I think the average Amazon employee makes $30,000 a year. You know, it's, and I live in New Jersey. You live on the East Coast. You know, that is like poverty wages. You can't even get a basic roof over your head. And you know, I hear a lot of the same arguments. Well, work harder, find a better job, and they just fall flat. they just fall flatter and flatter for me. I mean, do you think, like, I feel like corporate America and the transnational corporate model is just doing so much damage to all workers, especially, you know, workers who are women, minority workers, etc. What are some of your thoughts on that?
You know, I don't necessarily. You'll find a lot of particularly radical feminists who want to blow up any kind of hierarchical systems. And chapter 15 in my book is ultimately about my experience of trying to be a part of an organization that did blow up those systems and did not have a CEO. And quite frankly, it didn't work. And so I actually believe in hierarchically based systems. They're not the problem. The problem is in who's at the top. So if you take a look at the first phase of the coronavirus, you know, what do Finland, Norway, Iceland, Germany, New Zealand, and Taiwan have in common? They all did extremely well in the first phase of the coronavirus. What else do they have in common? They had a woman as a head of state. And what was it different about those women? First of all, they were open to correction and collaboration and compromise. You know, and the key element in all six of those women is they had great confidence coupled with great humility. You know, Henry Nouwen always used to say that the greatest leaders in history have always had equal parts confidence and humility. And the truth is, you'll find a whole lot more women with those paradoxical strengths than you will men. So, you know, take a look at the three countries that did the worst in the first wave of the coronavirus, Brazil, the United States, and Great Britain, and look at their leadership. Where there was hubris, not only confidence, but not 1 ounce of humility.
Okay.
So I think really, if we had leaders who were people of incredible character, you know, one of my friends is Scott Case, who was one of the founders of Priceline, and he started another company, Upside Travel. And how they've treated their employees through COVID, and they're a travel company. They do business travel, and how they've treated their employees is remarkable. So it's not always gender specific. Scott, you know, they've had me in to speak to their corporation several times. Their chief people officer has become a good friend. He's become a good friend. You know, there are powerful white guys out there who want to get it right. I do a lot of work with the Biden administration. I had the privilege of being one of the speakers for the inaugural prayer service, and his administration's getting it right.
So, you know, before I let you go, and again, I appreciate you coming on and making time. What are some of these, like, I guess I would call them ingredients. You know, like you said that you mentioned obviously intelligence, but also humility. What are some other ingredients that go into making a person who can be, you know, at the top of a company who is creating these more equitable systems and CEOs? Like, if you had a list of, like, here's some top five attributes, I would say, what would you say?
Yeah, and I think I would rather roll that into answering that, rolled into another question, which is, what do women wish men would do differently? And I can tell you the first thing they wish is that that men would assume a woman knows what she's talking about and treating her accordingly. I've never said those words in a conference that there hasn't been wild applause, if not a standing ovation. That's just huge for us. We're tired of being ignored and treated as if we don't know what we know. And then stop interrupting us, because men interrupt women twice as often as they interrupt other men. But I think there are some things that men need to learn. The first is deference. Deference is not a respected male trait. Women learn deference as a birthright. Men see deference as weakness. And unless men can learn deference, we're not ever going to achieve any kind of equity. And so what does that look like? When it comes to gender equity, it starts by being an ally, by saying, I'll do anything for you. I want to make sure you succeed. I will be the strongest cheerleader you have. That's not deference. Mm. Deference is moving from being an ally to an apprentice. It's moving from saying, you tell me what I need to do and teach me what I need to know so that I can reach out. I think that's really the first thing that needs to be done. I think that men need to learn the value of compromise and of collaboration and particularly of being open to correction instead of seeing that as losing. Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand was incredibly capable at this. Every time she took a wrong turn, she'd say, oh, I made a mistake there. You know, at the same time, we're not hearing that in the United States. So,
yeah.
And then I think the third thing men need to do is learn how to deeply, deeply listen. You know, I'm a pastoral counselor, and you could put all counselors out of business if we would truly deeply listen. I'm a person-centered therapist, which means I don't assume I have any answers. I assume the answers are within my client, and my job as a therapist is to help them remove the obstacles that are stopping them from finding their own answers. And I can't do that if I don't deeply, deeply listen. And I can tell you with great confidence, I'm a far better therapist as a woman than I was as a man. As a man, I was too quick to tell you what you needed to do. So I think just those things would make a huge, huge difference.
I agree. I agree. My wife and I have talked about these things a lot in our marriage and now we're raising a child and, you know, getting ready to do other stuff. And it's, I've had to really put a lot of effort and work into like those three things that you mentioned, believing my wife more often. Man, there's been times where I just feel so dumb afterwards. Like, where did that even come from? That like quick dismissal, right? And then listening better and not offering like, oh, here's how you fix it, like all the time. And, you know, I found that for me, asking for permission is like, hey, is this a you want me to listen conversation or are you looking for my input here? Like, what would you like? Has just done wonders for our communication as a couple. And
yeah, most of the time, women don't want an answer. Women are verbal processors. They just want someone to listen to them while they find the answer. Yeah. And men, on the other hand, don't do well with their feelings. Yeah. So whenever they are distraught, they are fixers and they ask their wives subconsciously to hold their feelings for them. And so they're always in fix-it mode because heaven forbid they should go into emotional feeling mode.
Yeah, that's really good. Well, listen, Paula, I appreciate you making time and coming on. Like I said, I'm going to put a link in the show notes to your book. But where else can people find you? Where can do you have a podcast? Do you do any kind of public work?
I don't. I'm too lazy to do that hard work. And I'm too old. I'm older than dirt. So I still have a blog. So it's paulastonewilliams.com.
Great. Well, I'll make sure I link that for sure. I'm also going to link your most recent TED Talk as well. I think that my audience really benefit from it. And I appreciate the work you're doing in these spaces.
I think that would be good. I think it'd be good to link that. I think also to link the first one. I think it's probably better to watch the first one. And if your listeners, watch the red sweater one first and the teal jacket second.
Okay, I'll put them both in order, so it's just a click and a click, nice and easy.
Yeah.
Thanks again for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's been wonderful being with you, Tim.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, promo code STAPLE20.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.